Thank you guys for coming. Welcome. This chabura I called Effective Altruism and Stucca. So the title itself probably requires an explanation just for some background. I got interested in this topic when this book called Doing Good Better by William Macaskill was recommended to me by a friend. And I'll get into what it's about. That's a big part of this chabura. He's an economist who presents this philosophy, this economic theory of charity or altruism called effective altruism that I basically just put on a bookshelf and didn't read for a while until it actually became infamous when a fellow named, what's his face? Who's the? Sam Bankman-Fried was found out to be a major fraudster after having been one of the biggest spokespeople for effective altruism. So I don't think, right, that's not just by pure logic, that's not a disproof. It does, just because one person did a bad thing doesn't mean that it disproves the whole theory. That being the case, it caught my attention. Okay, you know, here's this theory. There was a guy who made billions of dollars and was giving a lot of charity, and then it turns out that he was actually stealing or, you know, committing fraud. It piqued my interest. I read the book, and I thought it would be interesting to compare it to the philosophy and ethic of tzedakah. So that's where we are today. That's what we're going to try to do. I broke this down into four parts. We'll spend the vast majority of the time on parts one and two. Part one is basically going through what effective altruism is. And then part two, we're going to go through what Hilchot Tzedakah are. There's a section of Yeridah called Hilchot Tzedakah. Halacha definitely has what to say on Tzedakah. And then parts three and four are a little bit more analysis. I bring in a secular slash, actually even a little bit Christian perspective on charity, and then part four, I want to present just a little bit more Jewish ethic and modern takeaways. So without further ado, we're going to get started. So this book presents, and I am pretty quote heavy, so we'll start off by going through the source sheet. Early in the book, the author writes, and I'm going to read from the beginning of source one, effective altruism is about asking, how can I make the biggest difference I can? And using evidence and careful reasoning to try to find an answer. It takes a scientific approach to doing good. Just as science consists of the honest and impartial attempts to work out what's true and a commitment to believe the truth wherever that turns out to be, effective altruism consists of the honest and, on source number one, an impartial attempt to work out what's best for the world and a commitment to do what's best, whatever that turns out to be. As the phrase suggests, effective altruism has two parts, and I want to be clear what each part means. As I use the term, altruism simply means improving the lives of others. Many people believe that altruism should denote sacrifice, but if you can do good while maintaining a comfortable life for yourself, that's a bonus, and I'm very happy to call that altruism. The second part is effectiveness, by which I mean doing the most good with whatever resources you have. Importantly, effective altruism is not just about making a difference or doing some amount of good, it's about trying to make the most difference you can. Determining whether something is effective means recognizing that some ways of doing good are better than others. So he presents in his introduction five questions or things that you should think about as an effective altruist. You can see that in the middle of page one. And it's technical. It's not super advanced. Any college graduate could comprehend the analysis, but it involves certain technical ways of thinking. And I think it's just useful to try to at least get a sense for what exactly he does, right? One of the first things that he presents is a very convincing, I think, presentation that we in living in wealthy countries, he's writing from the United Kingdom to an audience of fellow wealthy countries, the UK, the US, Canada, and other countries, showing that globally we're really the 1%, and we're not just talking about, you know, let's say us in Riverdale, you know, just throwing out some numbers, you can see the graph on the bottom left of page one, which shows the global income distribution measured by income per year, right? And you could see the way it's skewed. For people earning $52,000 per year, that would put that individual in the top 1% of global earners. Someone earning $28,000 per year, which is the typical median household income for someone living in the United States, that puts someone globally in the top 5% of income, earners in the world. Someone earning $11,000 per year, which is the U.S. poverty line, is richer than 85% of people in the world. And again, these things aren't entirely perfect measurements, and he deals with the technical questions, like, okay, well, maybe cost of living and, you know, sub-Saharan Africa. He deals with that, but he makes a convincing argument, smoothing all those things out, that nonetheless, even a poor person, as determined by the United States, is in fact more well-to-do than 85% of the world. And this is measured in other ways as well. Life expectancy in the United States right now is somewhere in the high 70s, I think 78, 79 years, depending on if it's a man or a woman. In sub-Saharan Africa, it's 56 years right now. So really, really stark differences. He writes, I have the source in text on the bottom of page 1 from pages 19 to 20 of the book. From a survey of 13 countries, he writes that the extreme poor consume an average of 1,400 calories per day, about half of what is recommended for a physically active man or a very physically active woman, while spending most of their income on food. The majority are underweight and anemic, et cetera, et cetera. So I think these are all things that we probably know intellectually, but definitely when trying to think holistically about charity, which term I'll wind up scrapping for a stucco later on, but it's definitely something to think about. The one method that he presents at the beginning, and this is the chart on the bottom right of page 1, is to think, well, okay, how do we even compare who's better, you know, who's better off and who can give to whom? So one method is really just to think about life satisfaction, and you can do that by just surveying people and asking them, how happy are you? How well-to-do are you? And these surveys have been done from countries including China, the United States, Germany. These are all on the chart below. And it's a little bit small, but if you can tell, one thing that's interesting is that you can see that all of the countries show what looks like a linear progression of happiness increasing, happiness being from maximally unhappy to maximally happy, that being the x-axis, and then their annual income is on the bottom, and that is thousands of dollars, right? So as their income on the x-axis goes up, their happiness from 0 to 10 goes up on the y-axis. Now, right, that's the function. The interesting thing is that the x-axis is not perfectly linear. It's actually, it's exponential, right? Every step on the x-axis is doubling, right? First, we have $1,000 earned per year, then $2,000, then $4,000, then $8,000, which what that means is that, and he writes this on the top of page 2, but you can see it on the graph, is that a doubling of income will always increase reported subjective well-being by the same amount. For someone earning $1,000 per year, a $1,000 pay rise generates the same increase in happiness as a $2,000 pay rise for someone earning $2,000 per year, or an $80,000 pay rise for someone already earning $80,000 per year. And so, now just to summarize this outside, what he shows based on that is that arguably, if one of the outcomes of charity is to increase happiness, which, you know, he takes as somewhat of an axiom, but you can increase the same amount of happiness with $220 given to a poor Indian farmer as you can do with giving $28,000 to a U.S. individual who earns $28,000 per year. And he calls that the 100 times multiplier, that you can do 100 times more by giving to the absolute poorest people, which is interesting. And he shows this also on the graph in the middle of page 2, just to really hone in that we're so uniquely wealthy today, right? This is just showing GDP per capita over time, right? So if you look as late as the year 1800, it's not marked perfectly, but the GDP per person in the world, and this is, again, adjusted for inflation a few years ago when the book was written, but as recently as 1800 was roughly $1,400 a year. And then post-industrial revolution and more advanced modern medicine, where today the average GDP in the world is something like $42,000 per year. But again, most of that wealth is really centered in extremely wealthy countries. And if you see India, for example, on the bottom, right, the amount of wealth that wealthy countries have enjoyed has not been enjoyed by non-wealthy countries. So that's part of his presentation. Now, in the next chapter, he asks one of the questions we saw on page one was how many people benefit. That's something we should be thinking about. So he writes, this is in the middle of page two, the last block of text.
I'm just curious.
So
this idea that you can proportionately do more, and he's been debated for that, is life satisfaction.
Right.
That's one way of quantifying how much good you can do. Does he think that that's the primary one?
He doesn't. That's more of an illustration, He uses that to appeal to our intuitions that there are ways to quantify the amount of good we can do, and that it's not just wishy-washy, that I feel like being beneficent today and I'll give money. But he tries to just appeal to our basic intuition that, no, you know, there really are major differences in happiness and unhappiness. And it gets a little bit more technical, actually, here. This is the charts on the bottom of page two are from his next chapter. Mm-hmm. The quote that I have here is, it sort of illustrates his attitude, but you know, he's discussing a program that someone in, I think, South Africa thought it would be a good way to help people by donating books to poor communities in Africa. And his attitude, and I think it's telling, is that if those extra books don't actually improve anyone's lives, then your $50 donation is worthless, right? And I'd keep that in the back of our minds, because I think that that might be one of the areas in which his ethic is inconsistent with the halakhic perspective.
Worthless to whom?
On the moral plane, you do not do a good thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Except that's a question of what is the purpose of being generous.
I agree with you. Yeah. Right. And I think we're definitely going to get to that. But from his perspective, right? He's an economist. He's very.
No, I'm just meaning. That's the effective part of altruism. It's like
correct.
If you're looking at it as this, there's this is subjective. You accomplish the objective, right? That's a values thing.
Right, meaning said otherwise, he's utilitarian. And he spells that he doesn't spell that out in the books, but in interviews, he describes himself as a, I think, Benthian utilitarian, essentially that the good is a measurement of how much utility you're increasing in the human condition. And that's really it, right? All humans are essentially... He's universalist, that he doesn't have a notion of caring about your people more than other people. There is this human condition, and human happiness has to be increased. The more you do, the better, the less you do, the worse. Another, I don't know if we've picked up on this yet, but he's a student of a philosopher named Peter Singer, who teaches at Princeton University. He wrote an essay in the 1970s called Famine, Affluence, and Morality. It's controversial, but he says a lot of things in that essay, including he has this whole analogy that, you know, you're walking in Riverdale and you see a little child drowning in a pool and you just walk past and do nothing, right? We all have the intuition that you're a horrible person for doing that. And he writes, that's happening on the other side of the world in India and we're doing nothing. And he thinks that morally there's no difference, which again it's a very there's a rationale to that perspective. It's very utilitarian, right? It would suggest that, you know, probably the ethical thing to do is to basically live on the absolute minimum that you can and give all that you can away to charity. We're going to get there, but, right, so just to be a little bit more technical and then hopefully just quantify and think about effective altruism, the other measurement that he uses, aside from life satisfaction, are these charts on the bottom of page two, and it's a measurement called quality-adjusted life year, QALY, which he dubs QALY. I think it's not even his term. I think economists use this. So what is a quality-adjusted life year? So it can be measured in two ways. It's similar to self-satisfaction, to life satisfaction, but if you ask someone, how would you rate your, the quality of your life right now, right? 100% would mean essentially, it's somewhat subjective, but I feel great. Everything's functioning well. I'm happy psychologically, from a fulfillment perspective. I'm at 100%. You might go a little bit lower down if you have physical injuries, if you're sad. So the chart over here on the bottom. On the bottom of page 2, you can sort of see a typical, let's say, human's life, where he's near 100% at the beginning, maybe he experiences some setback near the middle of his life, and then he pulls himself together, and his quality of life goes up, and then he deteriorates and dies at around age 70. Okay, fine. So, quality adjustment is the heuristic that he likes using as an economist. So if you look at the graph on the bottom left of page 2, let's say you have this person, right, the first person, if you can see he has a certain quality of life, and he has that quality of life for 70 years. Now you, as a donor, could do something to his life. Maybe you get him some medicine or you give him a lot of money. But by doing that, you've improved his subjective quality of life by 20%. And he will be that 20% amount better for 60 years, right? Just think simple math. 60 years times a 20% increase, that's 12. Okay, so 12 qualities. By doing that, whatever that was, you just gave that man 12 qualities. And you could do it, right, that's vertically, if you could picture, right, making his quality of life better, but you could also do it horizontally.
You mean the fish. Summarize it in one way, right? It's like,
right,
you give a guy a fish.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying.
Or you buy him a fishing rod.
Right.
I could buy you a mackerel for $40. Or... and you'll eat like a king for one day. Or I can buy you a rod. You can eat okay fish for 30 years. Same
right.
Cost. Which one would you rather have?
Well, I feel like that's a definitely different analogy.
Of course. I'm simply saying that the principle of the matter is, when you're donating money, what one of the metrics I can look at is, like, I could help somebody for a short period of time, and it may be, but now my, and it could be the person's quality, but if you adjust that over this period, right, if it only lasts for a very short period of time, or if it lasts for a long period of time, but it's only a slight adjustment, those are all different metrics.
Yeah, I think that's definitely part of it, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's different. I think,
okay.
Thing number one is, for your entire life, improve the quality. Thing number two is, extend the existing quality for a longer amount of time.
Yeah.
Right, so it's like a third thing, which is like, would you rather be, live badly for a long time, or live great for a short period of time? It's kind of the opposite way, where it's like, if you sacrifice a little bit of your quality of life and you give somebody else a really increase their quality of life and they live even longer, those are all metrics that...
Right. What happens with the living longer is what you see on the bottom of that graph, right? Where he's not necessarily making someone's life better, but he's making it longer. So if you have, right, somebody, let's say, was at 70% life satisfaction and now he's going to live 10 more years, that's 7 more qualities. So again...
I understand that he's an economist.
It's very robotic, yeah.
Saying it's an economic value, but in what world is 10 extra years worth less than... if you gave someone an option, I guess it's subjective.
I know plenty of people who would say, pull the cord, I don't want to live like this.
Right, well, his argument would be that 10 extra years, 10 extra years at 0.1% quality of life is not that much.
We have to quantify it in some way, so we're going to...
I think there are a lot of... reasons to criticize this, but it has the virtue of being very quantifiable and mathematical.
That's subjective.
Correct. And I think a lot of us are starting to get a little bit of a sense that, okay, something feels a little bit not so good here, but okay, this is him, and he really believes in it. You read the book, he sincerely thinks this is the way to...
Yeah, I wasn't criticizing, I was just trying to understand what it was he was getting at.
Yeah, and it's not just him, by the way, this is gaining, and I'll get into this later, but this is gaining a lot of traction, especially in, the tech world and Silicon Valley, but yeah, what were you saying?
If you're going to get to this, you could just say that, and we can answer it later.
Yeah, sure.
We're going to get more valuable in Judaism,
we're going to get to it, right, so I think you might have stepped in a minute late, but yeah, what we're going to do in the next part is compare this to the
halakhic. This is the whole share.
I was talking specifically about just the years versus quality. Analysis.
So I'm going to try to, right, I think that's a question we're going to ask, and we're going to see whether or not Halakha has a yes or no answer to that.
Even beyond stuck with it.
Yeah.
So medical ethics in terms of end of life, but you can extrapolate even to you can take the principles of end of life and extrapolate it to more quote unquote senior years as well, and it's not even stuck with it.
I agree. I'm not going to get into that, but again, there are a lot of ethics of life out there. I think there allegedly is some Eskimo tribe that used to push senior citizens off on a boat out into the ocean. Okay, right. So it's not, this isn't the first year you'll ever hear on the Jewish ethic being different from other ethics, but that's not a problem. I think halacha is countercultural. That's not a bad thing. And well, okay, so just to get there, right? Moving forward a little bit, right? There's another chart on the bottom of page 2 that's also, it's another indication of showing how different our global wealth is compared to others. We can move a little bit past that, but right, looking on the top of page 3, right, this is still trying to think about, is this the most effective thing you can do? I think he also does a pretty good job showing comparing different charities is not, it's not just a question of like, is this a good thing versus like another thing that's also probably equally good. He shows, for example, on the top left graph, and this is a measurement not of qualities, but different things that they tried to do for African kids to get them to spend more years in elementary school. And they did different things. One of them was they just gave young girls cash. And another one was they gave merit scholarships. Another one was they gave free uniforms. And then if you look, the last one they did was they gave them medicine that got rid of the worms in their intestines. And that one, right, if you just think that all charities are equally good options, then you might not realize that in reality, one of them is dozens and dozens of times more effective at getting the goal than others. So that's something that he does a pretty cool job of showing. And he shows this on the top right also with, you know, the number of qualities you can do. And this is where it gets a little bit more, you know, it sounds like he's judging some people's lives over others, but it's like, it's worth thinking about that. You know, let's say you have one person who has cancer. He looks at someone who has Kaposi's sarcoma. It's a specific type of cancer, but he thinks that the cost of increasing his life by one quality, which either means he'll live a year longer or maybe he'll feel better, that would cost $50,000, right? Because chemo and, you know, the surgery, et cetera. Whereas he thinks that if you want to increase the quality of kids in Africa, and you can do that by getting them bed nets so that they won't get bitten by mosquitoes, that costs about $100. You'll increase a person's life by a year, essentially, which again, I don't think that means, you know, you have to prefer one donation over the other, but he does, right? To him, it's obvious that obviously you should give, let's say, $34,000, you know, $3,400 to bed nets in Africa because you'll extend a person's life measured by qualities, but essentially by 34 years. So to him, it's very obvious that you should give the money to there as opposed to basically anything in America because as good, you know, pick your best charity in America, you're not going to save that many lives with that little money.
I think, I've heard this discussion before. If you give a $50 donation to the ASPCA, you're saving...
What's ASPCA?
It's animal rescue.
Right? Okay.
Animal rights protection, but let's put them aside for a second. If you spend $15,000 on a cancer treatment for a pet dog, mm-hmm. that will increase its life for a few years, versus $15,000 for a human,
right.
would it... it's not to compare human to human, but it's that gets a little bit like sticky morally, I think, for a lot of people. They're like, "Wow, you're helping 50 people." But I'm asking the question: does he talk about like it's one person versus many? But then,
he's a humanist. I don't see anywhere in the book him talking about animals.
I need to say more. But how do you weigh the? He's literally weighing life of
yes.
a human and its quality, and that quality.
It's based essentially on qualities, yeah. Yeah, correct. Right, meaning it sounds a little bit jarring, I think, because it's very, I don't want to make comparisons to, you know, various genocides that have happened. That being the case, like...
A little eugenic.
It's a little something. I don't want to label it, but...
Pause for a second.
No, I mean... yeah.
It's okay. It can only hear him,
so... Right, whoever they are. Again, these are all, I think, good potential critiques that we're starting to have, right? And just moving forward, because I want to get to the next part of this shir, starting on the page 56, the next written source on page 3 of the handout, his next question is basically, is this area neglected? And we don't have to read through this inside, but he poses, you know, the question, what's more valuable, water or diamonds? And it's kind of a paradox. There's no right answer. If you're on a desert island and you're going to die from thirst, obviously water is more valuable to you, but if you're living in New York City and you can just get water from the tap for a tenth of a cent per gallon, then probably diamonds are better for you because you have enough water. And this is an economic way of thinking called thinking at the margin and thinking about the marginal utility. Fine. this isn't just, he's not just trying to get into theoretical economics. It's very practical. And are there any doctors here? Right? Because he actually suggests, and again, not ironically at all, that thinking at the margin, he thinks that you should actually not be a doctor because there's no reason to be a doctor. There's a surplus of people who go to medical school. Residency programs are bursting at the seams. So if you don't go to medical school, someone else will just go to medical school instead of you. And even though most people think that being a doctor is a very good thing to do because you save people's lives, thinking on the margin, the marginal utility is just how much good you will do as opposed to the other person who would get your position if you didn't do that. And he thinks that it's hard to argue that you're going to be so much of a better doctor than that other person, and therefore you instead should do something else. And that something else is what he gets to in the next chapter. And I'm going to read this inside just because I think it's striking, is a philosophy called earning to give. And this is where you can see why this really carries a lot of publicity and people like it a lot in Silicon Valley, right? He writes page 76, near the bottom of page 3, earning to give means exactly what it sounds like. And he sincerely thinks this is what you should do if you have the means and intelligence for it. Rather than trying to maximize the direct impact you have with your job, like being a doctor, you instead should try to increase your earnings so you can donate more, improving people's lives through your giving rather than your day-to-day work. Most people don't consider this option when choosing a career that quote-unquote makes a difference. But time and money are normally interchangeable. Money can pay for people's time, and your time can be used to earn money. So there's no reason to assume that the best careers are only those that benefit people directly through the work itself. If we're serious about doing good, earning to give is a path we should consider. And again, just like
Buffett talks a lot about this philosophy.
Who does? Buffett? Yeah. What does he say about it?
I mean, whenever he's specifically in defense of him not giving more charity now, he says, more effective for me to continue to compound my returns, and then eventually when I die, will somebody give away my money? Because I'm better at making the money. Somebody else is probably better at giving away the money.
Right. I think he actually touches on that in this book also, right? The question of donating now versus donating later. And Halakha has things to say about that also. And then just one other thing I'll mention is that, right, he has a lot of interesting perspectives, right? Thinking where goodness is measured so quantitatively, mathematically, and also he's really always thinking on the margin. He poses the question, literally, who is the best person who ever lived? And he has an answer to that question, and his answer is a man named Viktor Zadanov. And Viktor Zadanov was a Ukrainian virologist, and what did he do? He happened to be at, in the year 1958, the 11th World Health Assembly in Minneapolis, and there was a vaccine for smallpox promoted by Edward Jenner many years prior, but he came up with the suggestion that we, as a global community, should try to eradicate smallpox. And arguably, based on his suggestion, it caught wind, and within 15 or so years, smallpox was actually eradicated. And based on, it probably is the case that he pushed forward the eradication by around 10 years, and had it not happened until 10 years later, 10 to 20 million more people would have died of smallpox. And he says, therefore, he's the best person ever. Which again, that, you know, interesting. The person probably saved a lot of lives. The person also probably didn't think he was going to save that many lives. And again, it's because for him, it's specifically the fact that without him, no one else would have done it. Okay, Adkan, effective altruism. Any other, a lot of people had thoughts while we were doing it, but I'm happy to move on to the next part. Okay, so that is one take on what we should be doing with our money, and it's caught a lot of wind. Do some Google searches, look up what people are doing with their money in San Francisco, on Wall Street. It's popular. I know this anecdotally, that there are people who go to prestigious colleges, and their goal is to get the best job at the top Wall Street trading firm and donate a very high percentage of your money, and that's the best good you can do. Okay, let's start going through classical Jewish sources on Stucca. So the Torah tells us in Devarim, Ki hiyevcha evyom me'achad achecha bi'achad she'erecha b'arzecha asher Hashem lokecha notein lecha lo ta'amitza levavcha v'lo tikpotet yadcha me'achecha ha'evyon. Don't harden your heart. Don't shut your hands from your needy brother. Ki patoach tiftach et yadcha lo v'havitz avitanu de'mach soro asher yechsar lo. Open your hands to him. Give him de'mach soro. We'll see how Chazal understand this. Now, the halachot appear, in the latest organization in Shulchan Aruch in Yoredeya. There are a few simanim on Hilchot Tzedakah. There aren't so many black letter, let's call them, psukim in the Torah. There is that pasuk about Dei Machsoro. There are other psukim that have an impact on halachot. There's no Masechet Tzedakah. There actually are very few Mishnayot or Gemarot explicitly about Tzedakah. There is Masechet Peah, which is about like a Chichcha and Peah, which has a lot of concepts that Tzedakah draws upon. Aside from that, though, there's no Gemara Peah, there's Yerushalmi Peah, but there's no Bavli Peah. But if you look, that it's really only a handful of Gemaras here and there, a lot of which are presented in the style of, and I'm sure all of you have seen this, this Amora had this to say about Tzedakah. This Amora used to do this Tzedakah type of thing, which I think itself is already at first an interesting observation. And I'm going to hopefully talk on this by the end, but it suggests that Tzedakah, on the one hand, there are rules that define what halacha has to say about Tzedakah, and also it's much broader than, for example, Hilchot Kiddushin or Hilchot Sukkah. Okay, so the word Tzedakah itself, right, and another very broad point. Tzedakah does not literally translate to charity. Rabbi Weider pointed this out to me. The word charity comes from the Latin caritas, apparently, which means love or beneficence. Right, but it's the idea that, right, what would it mean? Meaning love is an interpersonal emotion. It's also, it could be a reason why someone gives money. You're walking past the poor person and you're heart draws you. There's this feeling that arises inside you in the moment. Maybe it's even spontaneous, and you're drawn by that emotion to give money. You can picture the plate being passed around during church services, and you give money. Again,
open your heart and open your wallet.
Right. Tzedakah comes from the root tzedek, which is justice. It's the perspective, and this is very clear if you look at the makor that we're going to go through, that It's not just you doing a kindness out of your heart, it's the right thing to do. There do exist wrong things in the world, and there are dues that you have to pay. Tzedakah serves that. It's not just the kindness of your heart. So Tamar helped me break this down into good categories that I thought were helpful. We're going to call them who gives, what you give, how you give, to whom you give, and what you get. These are not the titles that Rabbi Yosef Karo gave, but I think they're a little bit helpful, right? So starting with who gives, Shulchan Aruch tells us, Kol Adam Chayiv Litein Tzedaka, every person is obligated to give Tzedaka, Afilo Ani Hamitparnes Min Tzedaka Chayiv Litein Mima Sheyitnu Lo. The Gemara in Gittin tells us, anyone doing Daf Yomi, this came up a week or two ago, right? We have the Pasuk that says, V'ini Ticha, V'ini Tich, Amar Marzutra, Afilo Anim Yitparnes Min Tzedaka, Ya'aseh Tzedaka. Okay, so every Jew has an obligation to give Tzedaka. So that begs the question, what do you give? Which, said otherwise, is how much do you give, and what are you expected to give? So I mentioned that a lot of these discussions stem from the Mishnayot in Peah. The Yerushalmi on the first Mishnah in Peah records, and this actually appears in several places in Bavli also, but Yerushalmi, I think, says it the best for a reason that you'll see. Nimnu be'usha, they voted at Usha, shehei Adam mafrish chomesh minchasav l'mitzvah. A person should give a fifth, 20% of his property for mitzvah, which is tzedakah. This is based on Asera Asrenu by Yaakov Avinu, which, by the way, I think a lot of us might have the assumption that it's, 10%, an idea of ma'aser. What did you say? Right, Maaser, but again, this, and you'll see it codified in Shulchan Aruch, the next source, the mitzvah min v'mufchar, as Shulchan Aruch will say based on these gemaras, is really 20%. And there's a cute thing that you could think about, that a certain Rabbi Gamliel poses the problem that, wait, if you give 20% every year, after 5 years, you're going to have nothing, which if you compound 20%, wouldn't that, he probably is thinking that you take off another 20%. But anyway, they say based on that, you don't take 20% off every year from your capital. You only give 20% or whatever you give from your earnings, which as we would call today, capital gains or salary, but as opposed to your entire net worth. Right, so the expectation is that a person gives, and this comes down in Shulchan Aruch in the next Mikor, that the mitzvah min hamufchar is chomesh, 20%. Shulchan Aruch says, this is the top line of Shulchan Aruch here, Siman Resh Mem Tet, yeah.
They say min nevusha.
Yeah.
Many, many years of even rabbinic years before that. So it also, you know, you have to wonder what was being done beforehand.
Right, yeah, I think that's... Minus
seems to connote that there were different, like there were different opinions, and where the fifth comes from was that, you know, what motivated them to decide a fifth.
Right. Yeah, I think you're right. I didn't necessarily think about that.
We discussed before, like, did this come up because people were giving too much? And so they want to say, like, it's fine if you only give this amount.
It is a maximum, by the way.
Right.
Which I didn't make that clear.
Meaning that is maybe like a havamina, but in practice, maybe people weren't giving enough, and so there's an institutional minimum.
Right. It's a maximum aside from on your deathbed, you could have your estate could give more than 20%. Or yeah, I think there are exceptions also for wealthy or maybe very wealthy people. But yeah, I mean, principally it's really 20%, and then yeah, I think that's a good point to think about. But Shulchan Aruch writes ve'echad me'asara 10% mida benoni. That's let's say ordinary, average, pachol mikan ayin ra'a. Right, so definitely one can give less than that, but it's considered not ideal. In Si'if Bet, la'olam lo yimna adam atzma pachol mishlishi tashekel l'shana. Right, the basic minimum requirement below which one is not yotzei tzedakah mamish is a third of a shekel. I don't. Is anyone here a silver expert? I walk down the diamond district, ask them how much does a third of a shekel of silver cost. Probably not that much.
No. It's like $40 an ounce or something.
It's probably not more than
a couple of bucks.
Yeah. So, but anyway, that's the minimum requirements. That applies to anyone. That applies to people who don't have jobs or who don't have any money. And again, the idea being that if you are abjectly impoverished and you can't give that, then okay, you can't. But you know, that there is a basic requirement to give at least that. Bava Basra, the Gemara at near the bottom of page 4, Rabbi.
Right,
if one can induce others to give, his reward is greater than the reward of the one who gives, which we'll get to. I skipped over that because we'll get to it a little bit. But that comes up a little bit more later on. Also, like what types of giving should you do? But okay, fine. Right, this Gemara of Basra. We're going to see that come up. There's a famous Rambam who portrays a certain hierarchy of types of giving, and yeah, that Shulchan Aruch very much was based on Rambam, right? Rabbi Elazar in this Gemara of Basra, every day that he would daven, he would give a pruta, he would put it in the pushka, so to speak, and Shulchan Aruch was tel halacha, and that's, you definitely see a lot of people in shul when they get up to Becharoti Muhabrit and. Shulchan Aruch doesn't mention that. I don't know where that came from. Maybe that's a later minhag. But the idea that, you know, that's philosophically what you're showing is that the money isn't mine. It's from Hashem. And we'll talk about this at the very end. But there's a nice idea. You should put a pruta when you... And again, Rabbi Elazar did that. Shulchan Aruch quotes that as halacha. Rambam here, and this is what you're getting at of what type you should give, is Shmone Ma'alo Yesh Bitzdaka Zolam Alamizor. We're not going to go through all eight, but he presents... eight different hierarchies of tzedakah, and he writes mala gedola in the mala mimena. What's the greatest mala? Zeha machazik biyad Yisrael shemach. You strengthen, you help out the guy who is very impoverished or in a bad situation. V'notim lo matana o halva. You give him a gift or a loan. Osei moshu tafu. You have a partnership with him. Amamsi lo malacha. Help him find a job. Right, Project Ezra. We've heard of that. Kedei lechazik et yado. You help him out so that he doesn't need to ask for money anymore. And he goes through, there are different levels, but I think, what was the expression you were using before? Teaching a man to fish, something like that? So, Rambam promotes that. wholeheartedly. Shulchan Aruch quotes it as well. And that, right, that again, is that that's the halachic perspective on the greatest form of tzedakah. The Gemara in Ketubah, we're on the top of page 5 now. Tana Rabbanan de mach tzoro. This is a little bit interesting. We don't totally, I don't think we have to get sidetracked by it, but the Gemara itself has this interesting perspective that it might be somewhat subjective, where what is de mach tzoro? So it depends on the person, that there might be some person who he was used to riding around on a horse and having an eved walk before him. So it might be that it actually is a good form of tzedakah to bring that person back up to that place. Okay, we don't have to get too into that. Now,
In terms of the subjectivity of quality of life, the metric that he's using before, this would have a lot of ramifications for that.
I agree, right, meaning, because arguably that person is quite a lot sadder by being, perhaps, you know, in a position that the, you know, mathematically measured happiness, meaning the quality of life on a mathematical level is quite a lot lower in terms of, let's just say, dollars earned per year, but it's possible that the other person is actually a lot happier or, you know, used to it, which I think is telling about the Gemara here's perspective. The Gemara, the Shulchan Aruch essentially presents a similar analysis of Dei Machzoro in the next source. And then just the last point on what you should give is that this Gemara in Bava Basra, and again, you can see that there's a cluster, right? We've already had a few Gemaras from Daf Tet Yud or so in Bava Basra, because it's, you sort of have like an Amud or Daf or so of just like one statement after another. And one of them here is that, let's say you, there's a whole story and there's kind of an argument between Rav Papa and this Rav Sama about, oh, how can you give money to that person? Basically, the halacha winds up coming out that you don't have to necessarily give to a person who you think isn't a worthwhile ani, but that being the case, you should give at least a matana mu'etet, which also, Shulchan Aruch was that halacha, that you don't have to give, you don't have to give everyone all of your tzedakah, but you do, there's a notion that if someone walks up to you and says, can I please have money, you should give at least a matana mu'etet. Fine. Now, I think the next category, I think, is interesting and definitely unique. I think totally independent of what you see in the totally secular philosophy and effective altruism is how do you give? And Halacha has quite a lot to say about that. We see in Shulchan Aruch here at the bottom of page 5, Tzarich litzein hatzdaka b'sever panim yafot. You have to give tzedaka. You have to do it in a kind way. V'simcha v'tuv levav. You have to do it, you have to be happy almost when you do it. I mean, it's onenim ha'ani b'saro. You have to be empathetic with the ani. You have to really hear him out, listen to his pain. Umedaber lo, tifrei tanchumim, etc., etc. You should see in Sif Dalit here, im shal lo ha'ani v'ein lo ma'itim. Let's say the ani asks you for money and you don't have any money to give him. Lo yigar bo v'yagbiyo kolo alav. Don't yell at him and make him feel bad for asking for you something that you can't give him. Ela yifai subidvarin, you should talk to him, etc.
So how do you...
Yeah.
Have you balanced or weighed this? Like the Shulchan Aruch just saying, here's he gets to know the person, you have to talk to him, you have to do all these things, versus the notion that like it's better to get stuck anonymously.
Right.
So those seem to be two, you know, I don't know if they're at odds, so to speak, but one is like make it personal, talk to the person, raise them up, and the other one is just this, you know, just here. You know,
right, and you're correct. I mean, you're touching on Rambam in his list of 8 measures. He views it as better to give money in a way that you aren't necessarily connecting directly with the ani, as opposed to doing it directly. But I think at least in this case, he might be contemplating the ani going up to you directly.
Right. Okay.
So yeah, so I think, but yeah, that
in the case when someone asks you,
right, okay,
then you need to do it in this way. But if you have the choice, that's like if the chance happens upon you, how should you approach it? But then, if you're going to initiate, how should you give? It should be in an anonymous way for the covenant purposes.
I think so.
I think it may be based on the Rambam and the next source. I think it may depend on whether this halacha is either defensive, meaning that in a scenario where you know, were concerned about potentially hurting the Ani's feelings, and so the Chazal said, don't do that, we want to preserve the kavod, or that there's more of a social aspect, like more of like a pastoral element to tzedakah, that you're proactively supposed to do it. So depending on how you view the halacha, you know, that might depend on whether the Rambam thinks that, and the Rambam, I think, clearly takes that stand that it's to preserve the Ani's kavod as a defense mechanism. If you think that there's more of a pastoral element, then you might disagree with the Rambam in terms of the hierarchy.
And also, I think both of those elements are present.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Yeah, and also, right, and that brings, you know, touching on the next Rambam at the top of page 6, he really hones in a very dramatic way that Kol Nitin Stakalani B'Sever Panim Raot, Panav Kavusha B'Karka, right, we're sort of turning this on the inverse, let's say you do, in fact, give money in an unfriendly, unkind way, Afilu Natan Lo Elev Zehuvim, even if you gave him 1,000 gold pieces, Ibeid Zchuto V'Hifsida. Rambam thinks that it's, you essentially totally lost the merit. Compare this to what we saw 20 minutes ago in effective altruism. It's totally the opposite. Effective altruism says, I don't care how you give your money. I don't care if you're the biggest jerk being a total leech to society. Or meaning, to be totally fair to him, he himself has gone on the record that he doesn't think you should do criminal activities to earn money. But even just, you know, types of careers that we wouldn't necessarily think of as being as good as traditionally good things, like being a doctor or being a teacher. It's more, do what you can to make the most money, and I don't care how you do it, but...
be a lawyer.
Right. Okay, sure. Good. So you could say a control lawyer.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. For Rambam, it's no. Like, the amount that you give matters, but you could totally ruin it if you give it in a not nice way. Okay, now, to whom should you give? Okay, so... there's a Gemara in Tubot here that talks about, let's say there's a Yatom and Yatoma, right? There's there's a boy orphan and a girl orphan. We should infarnes the Yatoma. We should pay the girl orphan first. Again, not just for the sake of time, we don't have to go into the reasons why. Shulchan Aruch brings down a lot of these also. There are all sorts of interesting precedences. We possibly don't have to give tzedakah to an Avarian. Maybe in a purely halachic society, we'd have to give tzedakah to a Kohen and a Levi before Yisrael. I didn't see in the Nosei Kelim anything telling us that we don't do this today, but my sense is that we don't do this today. Maybe you have more clarity why. But yeah. I just assumed it was probably because they don't serve the role that.
Yes, I can't speak for our local rabbi discretionary, but I think Mayfair didn't use to be supposed to. It's more just from a function, like function.
Okay. Meaning the halacha is to give precedence to Kohanim and Levim before Yisraelim.
Well, again, I mean, precedence is a relative term.
Right.
Meaning, so if a Kohen and a Levi in Yisrael all walk up to me and I have $2, so Yisrael, okay, halacha shouldn't get from me at this juncture in time. But like if you just cut a check to an organization, so like I don't think you have to like go calculate, I could allocate my money to like a Kohen oriented fund or anything like that.
Okay.
And I think it's just more like a logistical thing.
Okay. I think that definitely is the sense, right? Because if it were purely like you always have to give to the Kohen first, that itself would be inconsistent because there are other things that come up for right. Including here. There's an idea of your Krovim come first. And this is in Sif Gimel, you can see, right, your Krovim come before anyone else. And after your Krovim, there's the Anye Beto, poor people in your household.
What about number one? What does that mean?
That in theory, you don't have to give tzedakah to an Avarian. And if you do, it might be for Darkei Shalom reasons. That's an interesting thing to talk about, I think, just for time purposes. We could leave that aside for now.
I don't think I've ever seen that before.
Yeah.
You have to argue to use rabbi's discretionary fund. That. I think the blurb on the website is like, we give to all Jews, no matter...
Yeah, I think exactly for that reason, that it's been made Darkei Shalom. Also, again, it's over a Avarian B'Mezer B'Farhesia.
This is all just to kind of critique the RJC.
There's no assistant rabbi's discretion.
That is what we're appealing for right now. If you please, open your hearts and open your wallets.
Anyway, moving on so we could right, wrap up soon, right? There's an idea of Yehu aniyim, Yehu aniyim b'nei beitecha, you should have aniyim present in your house, etc., etc. You should, if an ani comes up to you and says, feed me, ein botkim acharav im huramai. This is Sif 10 on page 6, right? We don't audit him on the spot, maybe audit him later, but elam achilim tomiyat, feed the guy. The guy comes and asks you for food, give the guy some food. And again, right, I think we already see competing values, but these are all things that come up. I'm going to skip what's on the top of page 7, just because we're running low on time, but there is a whole interesting discussion. There's Rav Aaron Lichtenstein essay on this called, it was originally published in Hebrew in a journal called Sefer Zichron Avram Spiegelman, translates to the responsibilities of the recipients of tzedakah. But he has a whole interesting question of how does halacha think about the poor person who is being lazy and basically choosing not to earn money? And the answer in classic Rav Aaron Lichtenstein fashion is it's complicated. So these makarot on the top of page 7, this Gemara in Ketubah with Machloket Rabbi Yehuda Chachamim, has a lot to say about that. Lahalacha, Rambam and Shulchan Aruch do in principle say that a rich person who chooses to make himself poor is not deserving of tzedakah, but again, there's interesting discourse there. There's Machloket Kliyakar Meiri. Again, we could discuss that later. But just to close up Shulchan Aruch, right, what do you get? Now, obviously a secular philosophy will have nothing to say about that, but Halacha does have things to say about that. Shulchan Aruch begins its discussion on Hilchot Tzedakah with Kol Ha'ma'alim Einav Mimena Tzedakah Nikra Bil Ya'al. You're wicked if you don't give Tzedakah. And Rambam tells us, Lo'olam in Adam Ma'ani Min Hatzedakah. No one ever became impoverished by giving Tzedakah. The last Mishnah in Peya says a lot of things, but it tells us, among other things, Kol mi she'eino tzarich litol v'notel, eino nifar min ha'olam ad she'id tzarich lebriot. The person who doesn't need tzedakah and instead does take tzedakah, before he dies, he's going to be dependent on others, right? Again, there's this notion that min ha'shamayim, something's going to happen to you for misusing tzedakah. Gemara in Bava Basra, also this idea that rodef tzedakah v'chesed yim tzachayim tzedakah v'chavod, pasuk for Mishle, that, again, people, you should pursue tzedakah, and I think, I don't know if it says it here, but there's this notion, and probably is the one in the Makor that I passed over, but that it's usher to test Hashem in every single facet of life except for tzedakah. You can, this is explicit Gemara, I thought it was here, but it's probably in one of the other Gemaras of Basra, but that it's legit. Right, it's legitimate to give tzedakah with the assumption that as the Agadat Estelas, one will become wealthier or be fine for giving tzedakah. So that's not all there is to say on Hilchot Tzedakah, but I think there's a lot to hone in on in terms of the values that are manifest in Halacha, and I think they're very different from the secular humanist one, at least one of them that we saw. I guess I'll regal achas. Does anyone have any reactions at this point that they didn't have before?
Go on. What is the, I guess, what's the benefit? I guess that's the right way to say it. Like, what is the benefit of only giving a fifth?
As opposed to more. Well, I think we read this, that you're not supposed to give so much tzedakah that you yourself will become an ani who needs tzedakah.
Understood, but I can, you know, we can play that game where we're talking about, you know, numbers of money where I can give 50% in theory, but I should only be giving 20%. I'm saying, like, at what point, where does the utility of that, you know?
Well, I'm going to get to that, right? So, I mean, it could be as simple as it's a drasha, because it's based on the pasuk Asera Aseranu by Yaakov Avinu. But also, one meaning, I'll mention this at the end since we're wrapping up. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, I heard secondhand as saying that one thing that we see in Hilchot Tzedakah is that it's very broad, right? There are, the way that he puts it, I don't know if I would have said this on my own, but I think you do see it, that there are kind of guidelines and values to keep in mind, but it's not such a strict function, you know, input output. And he says that the fact that it's broad, in his words, isn't a kula, but it's a chumrah, because it puts a much greater responsibility on the person with means to think very carefully about what should I balance. And right, I agree, meaning, I don't know, how do we get to 20% as the ideal? I don't know, but that being the case, right, it's a complicated thing. There's also, there's some story that I heard in pursuing these Makarot that someone once won the lottery or got some Yerusha or something, and he was in Israel and he asked Shlomo Zalman, who should I give this money to? And Shlomo Zalman allegedly told him, if I had the answer to that, I would have gotten this Yerusha instead of you. The point being that, I don't know, you got this Yerusha for... And he said, it's complicated, and it's your Nisayon to think about it very carefully. There's also, right, there is the question that we see this as well, right? There's the balance in halacha itself between giving to Aniye Yirecha, and that definitely is the case. There's a very strong preference to giving to your own Aniyim. But at the same time, there is a notion of, you know, the most abject people as well. Halacha does care about that as well.
Yeah. Either of those is your family.
Yeah, you're correct. But I'd put that in the same umbrella as Aniye Yirecha. Rav Hirschel Schechter has said on different occasions, again, I also read the secondhand in doing research for this, that he thinks the proper balance is one should give 80% locally, and that includes local yeshiva. And again, this is all poskim today think that supporting yeshivas, paying for shul membership, those all count as tzedaka. And he has said the number 80%. That's not written anywhere. That's not in Shulchan Aruch. So it's, you know, it's more in the realm of reasonable. Someone who is very steeped in all of halacha, you know, has a sense
should,
that that's...
Should I only be given to Jewish charities as opposed to, I'm saying...
Halacha doesn't have a clear-cut answer on that, you know.
They do have the hierarchy of who you should be giving to, right?
Right.
So, it seems to only include Jews.
I think not only, meaning I think... As you expand, you know, you move out of your family, your community, etc. You eventually do get to the poor farmers in India and Africa. And I think it's complicated. I don't think that halacha thinks it's not worthwhile at all to donate to sub-Saharan Africa. But, you know, there's, you know, maybe that 80%, 20% balance that Rav Schechter contemplates. And I don't know what the answer is. I think it is worth thinking about that. You know, the difference between us and the most poor today is quite a lot starker than it was in even, you know, medieval Europe. You know, Jews in Poland, I think, were probably a lot similar to Aniyim in the worst parts of the world. So again, I don't know what the answer is. These are all things to think about. In part number three, we could skip over this, but Ross Duth out of the New York Times, this is on pages 8 and 9, presents an essay. You can read it on your own, but I think he has a lot of thought-provoking analyses of effective altruism,
just
spanning all the
here talk about like beyond giving to an honey, like what other forms of that, like similar to what Schechter was saying.
Does who talk about that?
I'm saying, is there, meaning when you think about prioritizing giving,
right?
Like Talmud Torah versus like, I don't know, giving to an organization like Hatzalah or other things where there may be a more direct, you know, impact on somebody. Saving somebody's life versus teaching, you know, enabling more people to learn Torah. Like, how do you kind of balance?
Right. I mean, again, from what I've seen, there definitely is a notion that if there's a person proverbially at your doorstep, that's one thing. But, you know, that aside, it's kind of a value judgment, and there isn't necessarily a one size fits all answer.
We asked that to our reader when we like did our finances when we got married. Like, okay, how much Tonkei Shabbos? How much should you bet? Like, how do we?
Right.
Again, you know, there isn't necessarily an answer, as Ron Lichtenstein would put it. That's a chumrah, so to speak. Right. Just to quickly close things up. Right. Ross Duth said, I think he has some sharp analysis. Right. One characterization he has in the middle of page 8 of the effective altruist. He writes, picture effective altruists sitting around in a San Francisco skyscraper, calculating how to relieve suffering halfway around the world while the city decays beneath them. Which I think it's cynical, but I think it's also not totally unfair. He also writes, you know, anyone who comes to you bearing a too neat calculation of moral worth and obligation, an exacting plan for the maximized utility of humanity writ large, will inevitably slide into treating some actual human beings as expendable. Marks and suckers if they're lucky, candidates for euthanasia if they're not. Which again, harsh, but
right,
I think that's arguable. Right, I think that's arguably one reading of how did Sam Bankman Fried happen. And look, you can look into it on your own. He wasn't just, you know, someone who happened to be a guy who liked effective altruism. He was their poster child. They did conferences with him. They talked about him. They wrote about him.
I think a different person that also does something similar is a Bill Gates type character.
Correct.
For better or worse, chickening everybody in the world, blah, 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 right? Like all the nonsense.
And he endorses this book also, yeah.
Right, like supporting malaria because that is a net positive versus like, I can do stuff here that'll maybe benefit me more. There's something to that.
Yeah, and it also could be that the way that, you know, a multi-billionaire should think about Stucco is different from how other people should think about Stucco.
The way that Chazal weren't always thinking of planning in big picture, meaning they're saying a lot of it is almost reactive to certain constraints.
And I think part of that is a function of how the world works. Like, I don't think they could have contemplated that you could press a button on your computer and help out a poor person on literally the other side of the globe.
No, but you do see that, you know, that in Kafas Saka there is the Aniya Eretz Yisrael.
Right.
So you do see that there is this, you know, awareness of an other or more of a macro project or macro Jewish project that is not international or, you know, universalist.
And Aniya Yerecha, from what I've seen, does take reference to Aniya Eretz Yisrael.
Correct.
Yeah.
So and I think it's that because Chazal were more focused, I think it's a bigger trend than Halakha that we focus on short-term observable phenomena.
Right. And also, like, the idea is that it probably creates, it's not just about preserving life, that might be part of it, but it's also about creating a certain kind of community where people are kind and do kind things and don't have a poor person just starving on the street in front of you.
Isn't it possible that it's also not just about that moral, God, in our belief system, God could just fix all the poverty, right? The purpose, if we can understand it to some extent, is like a Tzelmelo Kim opportunity of what is the point of doing this? It's to make us better humans. So if you're giving up to the far-flung person, it's not this observable thing.
Right.
How much impact is that having? Versus if you just ignore the person starving in the far-flung place and you have that blindness to that far-off moral quandary, that's also problematic. But how much impact is either one having?
Right. I mean, I agree with meaning. I think just to put it in like more categorical terms, I think what you're saying, and I think correctly, is that Halacha thinks that Stucco has an impact on the person itself, not just on the receiver, and that's significant, as opposed to a more humanist philosophy. And I think, secondly, Halacha is not utilitarian. Halacha does not think that... I'm not saying it's never utilitarian. I'm saying that Halacha wouldn't say, like Peter Singer, that by you making the decision to not donate to Thailand, that is equivalent to walking past a child drowning.
Correct. Isn't strictly utilitarian.
There's no way, because if it were, then 95% of Hilchot Stucco would fall apart. So it can't be that that you choosing to not donate to Thailand is equivalent to letting a child drown. Just to wrap things up, I think Moshe Rabbeinu tells us in his final speech to Bnei Yisrael, "V'ram levav levavecha v'shachachta Hashem lokecha." Right. One of the dangers of what can happen to Bnei Yisrael in the future is that you'll grow haughty, you'll grow rich, and forget Hashem. "V'amarta bilvavecha kochi v'otzem yadi asali et echayel hazeh." It's all from me. I caused this to myself. "V'zacharta Hashem lokecha." But what you ought to do is remember Hashem. "Ki hu hanotin lecha koach lasot chayel." Etc., etc., right? All of it comes from Hashem. We'll skip the Rav Aaron piece because that's a little bit more on the recipient choosing to be lazy, which we said we would skip. We'll skip the Gemara in Bava Basra also. You can read it on your own. Interesting machloket Rabbi Akiva Turnus Rufus about what Stucco is all about. It's what I call the 2,000 year ago version of this Chabura, where Rabbi Akiva was distinguishing from the effective altruism of the time, which was the Roman ethic of Stucco, which was totally different from the Jewish perspective. You read it on your own, it's interesting. But I want to just finish off, so to speak, at the start. The Torah, not the Shulchan Aruch, but the Torah, in his introduction to Hilchot Stucco, writes beautifully, and I'll just summarize, but he portrays, right, let's say you have a person who has difficulty giving tzedakah, which it's hard, giving away money that you earned. He says, it's going to be less hard if you think about it not as your own money, but think about it as a pikadon, a trust. And it's not your money, it's the money that Hashem gave you, and you're not giving away your money, you're giving away the grantor's money, the money of the mafkid, that being Hashem. And the Torah tells us that if you do that, you'll have an easier time with tzedakah, and you're in fact going to find osher v'kavod yourself, and it's going to be docheg zero kashot. And I think it's a very beautiful way to think about tzedakah, and a bracha that I would give to any of us here and anyone listening is that, again, I don't want to speak in generalities, but, you know, we are fortunate to live in the United States where comparatively we are very wealthy, and that's not to say that there aren't hard times. The economy definitely is down right now, but on the whole, we live well, and we should definitely take full advantage of what's really bracha, to have the opportunity to have enough money to give tzedakah, and it's something that is a halacha. There's a real kiyum hamitzvah in giving tzedakah, and there is a lot of bracha that the Mekorot presents as generating by doing that. So thank you all for coming. Any final comments? But otherwise, we can wrap it up. Okay.